Hello, Tim here. This is the last of four episodes that we recorded for economic policy papers on European and global issues. We hope that you have been enjoying them. Normal service for Vox Talks Economics returns next week.
They expand consumption and investment. They expand fiscal deficits. Public debt goes up, but international reserves start going down. And inflation remains kind of stable for a while, but in the year 4, 5, and 6 starts increasing significantly.
What policies do populists pursue, and what are the consequences both for their countries and for their regime? Welcome to a series of podcasts featuring the papers that were commissioned for the second Economic Policy Papers on European and Global Issues Conference, held in June 2026. I'm Tim Phillips. In Latin America, there have been populists of the left and populists of the right, and many of them have had a huge impact on the economies of their countries. There's been a lot of research recently on the causes of populism. But what about its consequences for the region? Alejandro Werner of the Georgetown Americas Institute is one of the authors of a paper that asks exactly this question. And he joins me to share some of the answers. Alejandro, welcome.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Alejandro, there has been a long, long tradition of populist leaders in Latin America. For this research, how far do you go back into history?
As you said, Latin America has a long tradition of populist leaders. The term caudillo, it's also very close to the populist leader, no? And we can remember Juan Perón in Argentina, also Carlos Menem in Argentina, Getulio Vargas in Brazil, and obviously more recently, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And Nicolas Maduro that was just ousted at the beginning of this year in that operation by the U.S. military. In our research, let's say the econometric exercise covers from 1970 to the present. And obviously, we have a little bit less data from 1970 to 1990 and a much more populated data set from 1990 to 2025. That's a little bit the coverage we discuss. The different stages that populism has had in Latin America. First stage, let's say from 1930 to the 50s, where we have, let's say, the buildup of a more urban societies in Argentina, Brazil, etc. Populist, let's call them institutions, were put together by Juan Perón, Getulio Vargas, even the PRI in Mexico, no? And that ends in the 1950s. Then we have another wave in the 1990s that it's more of a right-wing wave after the 1980s debt crisis and the lost decade in Latin America where most countries did not grow in per capita terms. We had this wave of populist right-wing leaders basically putting an agenda close to the Washington Consensus. And then the last wave that is the most recent one that is currently ending that started in the early 2000s on the back of huge income windfalls from commodity prices. And that was mostly left-wing populist governments, Nicolas Maduro, the Kirchners in Argentina, and Rafael Correa in Ecuador are some of these regimes.
So we have a pretty large data set here, but there have been populists all over the world in recent years. Is there something distinctive about the policy priorities of Latin American populist leaders?
Yeah, the Latin American experiences, both left and right, the populist leaders were mostly focused on economic issues. On the left, highlighting income distribution, poverty, inclusion, and on the right, focusing on reform, growth, investment. We have less of a focus in terms of our populist regimes on cultural issues, on migration issues, on social issues. Although in the 50s, there was a lot of inclusion and enfranchising different groups of society, I would say that when you compare them to other populist regimes in Europe that are more focused, especially on migration, on the Latin American side, in the sample that we cover, economic issues were very salient, Obviously, lately, we have one very important example that focuses on security issues, that it's El Salvador with Bukele. That is not part of our sample. Maybe it's a couple of data points, but it doesn't weigh a lot. But now we start seeing with the pickup of insecurity in Latin America or the broadening of insecurity issues beyond some key countries like Mexico, Colombia, Brazil, but now affecting most of the countries in Latin America, the approach towards security issues in some political leaders merging the populist leader with the security issue at the center of their policies.
I said that there has been more research into causes than consequences. I mean, certainly that's my impression from reading the literature and talking to some of your academic colleagues. Am I correct?
Yeah, and I think that reflects an introspection by a lot of policymakers and economists saying, how do we get here? More than
yes.
What are going to be the consequences? In the case of Latin America, the seminal work by Rudy Dornbusch and Sebastian Edwards in the early 90s, documenting through case studies what they describe as the macroeconomics of populism, was accepted, not subject to further tests. And I think then we had a new wave of populist leaders. And that is why, with my colleagues Antonio Spilimbergo and Nicolás Magut, when I was still working at the IMF, we said, look, we have had almost another two decades of new populist regimes. It would be good to start putting together all of these experiences. But you're totally right. Much more work around the world on the causes than on the consequences. And it's important to highlight a paper that appeared in the American Economic Review in 2023 by Fanke and co-authors that actually looks at consequences. And it's along the same lines as our paper. They did a lot of work creating their own index of populism, something that we don't do. It's a very important paper in this strand, looking at the consequences of populist regimes.
What particular economic consequences interest you?
We wanted to test more rigorously what Dornbusch and Edwards showed in their case studies, in their book, because also in Latin America, we have had cases of unsustainable macroeconomic policies, crises that took place under pretty orthodox neoliberal regimes that would not be termed as populist. Although we can show that populist leaders behaved in a certain way, scientifically, you have to prove that that way in, let's say, the outcome variables that you are interested was statistically different from what non-populist leaders did. We wanted to test two things. Populist leaders affected societies in two dimensions. One was institutions. We looked at the effect of populist regimes on institutional strengths, and we find that populist leaders negatively affect the strength of institutions. Democratic accountability, property rights, business and financial freedoms, government efficiency. And then we test the impact of populist leaders on fiscal deficits, international reserves being held at the central bank, public debt, aggregate demand. And we've shown that what Rudy Dornbusch and Sebastian Edwards documented 3-4 decades ago still holds in a slightly more robust econometric test, in which we show that in the first 6 years of these leaders or these regimes, they run very unsustainable policies. They expand consumption and investment. They expand fiscal deficits. Public debt goes up, but international reserves start going down. And inflation remains kind of stable for a while, but in the year 4, 5, and 6 starts increasing significantly, in some cases reaching 3-digit level, like Argentina before Milei. And obviously, in the case of Nicolás Maduro, having 1 or 2 episodes of hyperinflation during his tenure. No, so we kind of test both of those things. And obviously, both things could be interconnected. Weakening institutions eventually allow the government to really run these unsustainable policies because the checks and balances in society start to become weaker.
Okay, Okay, so let's talk about how you put this research together. And the first thing I have to ask you about is how you define populism, because many economic papers would define populism by the policy choices. Obviously, you can't do that. What do you do instead?
Exactly. The Dornbusch and Edwards book, I would say they describe what they coined the macroeconomics of populism. So I wouldn't criticize that work at saying, look, they have a tautological definition of populism saying populist leaders are those that run irrational and unsustainable economic policies. Therefore, mm-hmm. if we test if populist leaders run unsustainable policies, we will say yes, because that's how we define leaders. I think what they did is basically said, look, let's take these case studies. And there are a lot of commonalities, mm-hmm. so we can define the macroeconomics of populism. The political science literature has come to this definition. Populism, they call it a thin ideology, saying that could actually live together with many other ideologies like left wing, right wing, etc. And what they say is that basically this ideology considers society to be divided in two big groups, the pure people, the common people, and the elites. And the political economy equilibrium moves towards a situation in which the elites take significant advantage by building institutions and by building the rules of the game to exploit the common people. And then the populist leader is that leader that sees himself as the representative and the defendant of the common people vis-a-vis the elites. Then when they come to power, that defense can actually take place by a huge privatization program, selling government assets that had been taken over by bureaucrats, and the bureaucrats were the elites. Or it mm-hmm. could be a program in which we nationalize those assets because the private sector, through monopoly pricing, was taking advantage of those. So both things can combine depending on the narrative and on where the economy or the political economy equilibrium was. We take this definition, and then we use an index created by Professor Hawkins from the University of Brigham Young, where what he actually does is with a group of other professors and students, they form a continuous index of populism that they put together in what they call the Global Populism Database. They have a methodology in which this group of people, for all the governments that they cover 77 countries from 1970 until today. They read some key speeches by the president, maybe a key campaign speech, the inauguration speech, and some State of the Union speech. And they look for key issues. One is an anti-establishment rhetoric. Secondly, this us versus them narrative, appeal to the common people. Simple language to address and to reach the common people. They rate these things on a scale, and then they form this index. We start with a fuzzy concept. This is not monetary mm-hmm. policy and a short mm-hmm. rate, interest rate, that we can measure up to 0.001 basis points. And then, obviously, the implementation of that also has problems. But first, it's not defined by outcomes. We don't define the populist leader like one that destroys institutions, or one that runs unsustainable fiscal deficits. So at least it's much more exogenous than the other definitions. And secondly, it was not undertaken by us. If you're an author and you say, look, I'm going to combine these three sets of hard data, in the combination of those three things, there might be a bias. But when you start rating speeches, the biases could be large. No, if I hire a bunch of left-wing students, I will get something. If I hire a bunch of right-wing students, I will get something else, no? So in a way, at least, it is not our biases that then we will be running these regressions that are called local projections. And at the end of the day, the results that I quote through this methodology tell us the difference between the populist leader and the non-populist leader. It's not saying that populists were expansionary. It is telling us that populists were more expansionary than non-populist leaders using the Hawkins index. And given the fuzziness and the complex nature of the index and the concept, we do a lot of robustness checks. we took also the Funke et al. Index and we use it or definition. And we also take the Dorbush and Edwards methodology or subset, and we expand it with Hawkins, and we do another set of regressions. And all those robustness checks give us similar results. So we are confident that our results strongly show these correlations. They're much weaker if we really want to establish causation, because, I mean, when we use instrumental variables, et cetera, some of those uses have weaker statistical power. But at least at the correlation level, I think we establish it in a more precise way, especially measuring the difference between populist leaders and non-populist leaders.
So let's accept that you have a consistent, a useful definition of populisms. You've got your set of populist leaders. When they come to power, are there particular economic conditions that apply to the set of populist leaders that would not apply elsewhere, that might restrict how they make policy choices or the impact of those policies?
Look, in a way, they come to power in many cases, especially in Latin America, as a result of economic crisis or large periods of stagnation, high inflation. And in some cases, that constrains the implementations of their policy. So that's why sometimes it takes time for us to see. So for example, Hugo Chavez, he started with a policy that was not that far away from your traditional technical technocrats' implementation of policy. Eventually, Hugo Chavez found himself, after these 3 years of complex policy implementation of 4 years, that he was being blessed by one of the largest commodity income windfalls in history due to the increase in the price of oil that is the main export of Venezuela. And that lessened the budget constraints. And then you see the full implementation of this agenda. So in the last wave of populism in Latin America, a lot of these leaders came to power after crises, but eventually they found themselves kind of an unconstrained, at least from the short run, environment. Because given that South America especially, it's blessed with natural resources, energy, foodstuff, they were able to spend a lot to increase government expenditure, social programs, and that generated a long period of increasing growth, but also improving social conditions. However, when commodity prices stabilized, then they fell, then they started having problems maintaining this dynamic. And that's when international reserves started to come down, exchange rates started to depreciate, inflation started to go up. And that kind of was the beginning of the end of these regimes that eventually left power and left their economies, I think, in a worse position than regimes that were more orthodox, that use a smaller fraction of this windfall to push aggregate demand. They saved more and they were able to generate a much more sustainable, improved macroeconomic situation. And when you look at it from a 10, 15 year horizon, the countries ended up being in a better position, like is the case of Chile or is the case, for example, of Colombia.
Let's go through those macroeconomic results, put them in order. So we know that populists like to weaken the checks and balances on them. Is this the case for your data set?
Yeah. When we look at the institutional block of our econometric tests, we have Democracy Accountability Index, a Business Freedom Index, a Property Rights Index, and we do see that institutional strength in all of these dimensions starts to weaken significantly vis-a-vis non-populist regimes. And from the macroeconomic point of view, we also see that government expenditure increases by more than in non-populist regimes. Consumption and investment increases by more. It takes maybe 2-3 years to see these effects from a statistically significant point of view. And then we see that international reserves at the central bank start to go down. That actually tells us that a country can be running a policy that it's increasing government expenditure, consumption, etc., but the economy is able to fund this through foreign direct investment, through placing debt abroad. But when you start using the assets that you save, it's like those families that were rich in the past and start selling the jewels from prior generations. Now you start using your assets, depleting your assets. And that's what we see after year three or four of these regimes, and makes it sustainable, and inflation start to creep up.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, inflation, because of course there are some famous hyperinflation events. Can we say anything consistently about what happens to inflation?
Well, nothing is consistent in social sciences and nothing is consistent with populist regimes, because they also inherit some institutions, or de facto institutions, based on legal institutions that are very hard to break. For example, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, he was a populist leader. However, Ecuador was a dollarized economy, and dollarization was ingrained in society and was very popular. So Rafael Correa was not able, although at the beginning he actually wanted to get rid of dollarization, he couldn't. So in Ecuador, you don't see high inflation. However, in Venezuela, that didn't have the constraints and the chains of a very strong monetary regime, you see high inflation and hyperinflation. In Argentina, you also see devaluations, inflation, etc., and three-digit inflation. So taking all the sample and then taking the countries that also went through terms of trade booms, some expansions, but with non-populist leaders, like, for example, Chile. Chile had right-wing, left-wing, more extreme left-wing, but none of their leaders had a very high index of populism. And Chile has a very well-functioning financial system, low inflation, no capital controls. When we look at the difference, you might find populist leaders that have low inflation, non-populist leaders that have high inflation. But statistically, after the fourth year, populist regimes start exhibiting higher inflation than non-populist regime. That's what we find in our data. And the same is true with international reserves, that are the two, I would say, stronger yellow lights that we find in our paper of an unsustainable policy.
Is there a consistent effect on imports and exports? As you say, the latest wave of populists came to power on the back of a commodity boom. How do their policies affect the success of their imports and exports?
Yeah, I would say that exports remain, let's say, stable. It's truly not stable. They remain similar to non-populist regimes, and eventually they start to be lower than in non-populist regimes. Why? Because in a non-populist regime, there's more investment in these exporting sectors, because there's business freedom, there's financial freedom, there are more sustainable policies, so the private sector feels more comfortable investing in long-term projects. So we do see exports starting to suffer vis-a-vis non-populist leaders. However, what is important to highlight is, especially with commodity exports, it's not that important that your exports or production are coming down at 1% or 2% if the price of those exports, it's increasing by 50%. So they're getting a lot of money regardless of the inefficiency of the system, because the world is helping them so much through the price of commodities that it's an international determined price that has nothing to do with the populist leader. However, they're doing relatively less well than the non-populist countries, but the loosening of the budget constraint is still there. And on imports, I would say that imports start increasing by more, because the whole economic system pushes for an unsustainable expansion, and part of that expansion falls into imported goods. If you're doing unsustainable investment, you're buying machinery, etc., part of that machinery is imported. If you're doing an unsustainable consumption boom, some of those consumption goods are imported from abroad. So we do see stagnation and decline of exports vis-a-vis non-populist regimes, and we do see expansion of imports vis-a-vis non-populist regime, and therefore the trade balance and the current accounts start deteriorating, weakening the external accounts.
Now, whenever we discuss populism, there's a word that we always use, unsustainable. What has your analysis found about what determines the length of an episode of populism? Can we say anything about that?
Well, we don't go into a thorough econometric or statistical analysis of that. What we can say, focusing on the terms of trade, is that basically the terms of trade in the case of Latin America, that it's a commodity exporter, really significantly increase the length of time that populist governments were able to maintain themselves in power. That variable, I think we established it well, but we do not undertake a study of the probability of a populist regime staying for an extra year, and then evaluating kind of the probabilistic distribution and then taking expected times and trying to understand what are the determinants of that probability distribution. That's a very interesting question, but it went ahead of what we were doing, but I think it's a very interesting thing to do.
How strong is your causal claim from populism to these effects?
Yeah, as I said, that is weak. We feel very comfortable in our correlation results. We do try to take our exogenous variables in a way that there's less two-way causation, but as in every economic interaction that is heavily determined by political issues, it is hard for us to really claim strong causality. We do some instrumental variables regressions to try to address for this. Statistically, they're weaker, so we don't want to push our results that far. There's, I think, a smell of causation. There's a strong result of correlation. I mean, we start with a measurement of populism that is measured with error, because even the definition of populism, it's fuzzy. Democratic accountability. You look only at voting. You look at freedom of the press. You look at even-handed electoral process. Oof, all of these things are very hard to measure, and there might have been caused by conditions that happened in the past. No, so yeah, you can take a very like Acemoglu and Robinson approach, trying to see a very old determinants of institutions actually have an impact. Also, we don't have such a larger data set. So to really test causation, I think it requires more time, better economists, more creative people, and hopefully somebody will do it. Hopefully it's us. But I think this is a first pass. I think it's we went back to the Latin American experience that was not studied for a long time in a structured and statistically coherent way. And I think that's our contribution. And hopefully, as I said before, there will be more creative people that come after us that actually look at some of these deeper questions.
So when you talk to economists about populism, they generally don't have a lot of good things to say about it. But there is a reason that populists get elected in the first place. From your analysis, would you say that there are rational aspects of their policy choices?
We don't address that question on the core part of the paper, but we have a last section where we address these issues. And obviously, as former policymaker myself, and my colleagues still are policymakers, we have quarrels with the things we did as policymakers. No, babe, I mean, we were young, we didn't have the experience. We didn't know, we made policy under uncertainty and without full information, et cetera, et cetera. And some of these aspects that blindsided us and other policymakers eventually opened the door for this type of politicians to get to power. And I think first, we might have overestimated the impact of more technically accepted policies. Secondly, we underconsider the political economy aspects. If you have elections every 6 years, every 4 years, and it's very hard for your median voter to understand if an economy is doing well and his family economy is doing well because of the government or because of external conditions or because of unsustainable policies, the policies that you are implementing are the greatest policies in the universe, but will have, let's call them, convex effects. And the more important effects come after year five, maybe you will not get elected. Let's start including some policies that show some results in the present so that people vote for the continuity of the model. Secondly, sometimes as economists, look at the China shock literature. You say, okay, free trade is very good. We all know that, but there's winners and losers. Okay, we tax the winners a bit and we compensate the losers. And we implement also some policies that the losers are also not only compensated economically, financially with the transfer, but we put some retraining programs. We help them to move, to sell their house in manufacturing sectors and to buy a house in other places of the city. Okay, we as economists say all that. Then the policymakers, sometimes they don't do that and they don't do those policies well. And you don't have the time to do them. And so this logic of going through the first best economic policies and then implementing compensatory policies to minimize the welfare effects on the groups that loses from these policies, the implementation of that sometimes is forgotten, sometimes is done incorrectly, sometimes it's just weak. And then we have the political economy events. So in a way, I think it's very important that some of these populist leaders kind of introduce these ideas. Look, we have to elevate income distribution in the objective function of the policymaker in the short term, because yeah, there will be trickle down, but if the trickle down takes 8 years, maybe it will never happen because the politics will interrupt it in the middle. So let's accelerate the trickle down, even at the cost of distorting a little bit the economy, so that political economy equilibrium could be self-sustaining. The lesson that you're asking for is we have to elevate some elements that the populist leader brings into policymaking, like income distribution, social policies, regional distribution, maybe at a level that is close to the level of other policies, and maybe start thinking about not let's look for the efficient economic equilibrium and then talk about distribution. Let's also think a bit about, do we need to distort a bit the economic equilibrium and not be so purist and say, let's go for the first best on the economy and then we do redistribution. Regional disparities, income distribution, health, informality, things that maybe the policy package has to be more comprehensive to be sustainable from a political economy point of view.
Alejandro, it's fascinating talking to you. This is obviously really hard work to do, but it is extremely informative about what is good policy, also what those long-run consequences of populism are. Thank you for talking about it.
No, thank you very much for inviting us.
The paper is called Lessons from Populism in Latin America, and the authors, Nico Magud, Antonio Spilimbergo, and Alejandro Verna, will be published in Economic Policy Papers on European and Global Issues, of course. This has been a Talk Normal production. Megan Bieber was the assistant producer, and the sound editor was Andre Zolgaria.